Activism, taking a stand for change.
You can call yourself an environmentalist, but you cannot be an environmentalist unless you have adopted a plant-based diet.
Changing the way we think about what we eat. Lobbying for a fashion industry with a conscience. And a woman who used a global spotlight to advocate for children, for AIDS victims, and for an end to weapons that kill long after the war is over. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51% The Women's Perspective. When President Bill Clinton announced he'd stopped eating meat and dairy on the advice of his doctors, it seemed to tip the scales of public opinion, shifting veganism from an earthy, crunchy fringe idea to one that deserved serious consideration. 10 years ago, an upstate New York farm animal sanctuary opened its doors, at first focusing on saving horses and cows from abusive situations. Catskill Farm Animal Sanctuary now is home to animals of all kinds, but has expanded into educational programs including a vegan cooking curriculum and a summer camp for kids that encourages campers to adopt a vegan lifestyle. Founder Kathy Stevens, whose latest book, Animal Camp, celebrates the animals she's known at the sanctuary, said the public's become far more receptive to the idea of a plant-based diet.
You started out with an idea in your head of a mission, but you've told me you actually pursued it in a very strategic way. You didn't walk into the farm and say, everybody, here is everything I'm envisioning. You took it piece by piece. Why did you decide to go that way?
Because I felt like if we're going to make change, if we're going to be an organization that's in it for the long haul and that ultimately not only saves thousands through direct rescue, but exponentially more than that through raising people's consciousness about veganism and how vital that is, that it was something that a mainstream audience wasn't so ready to hear forcefully 10 years ago. So even though from the first day our mission has been all about veganism, we very strategically started as a horse-focused rescue, horse and farm animals, but the first couple of big rescues were horses with very sort of dramatic stories. And while our mission statement talked about it, raising public awareness of institutionalized cruelty, it was many years later, well, 6 or 7 years later, that we created the educational part of our sanctuary, which is, of course, a very active vegan cooking program called Compassionate Cuisine, and a day camp for kids that includes a vegan cooking component. So, and then in addition to that, we're now also, I blog for the Huffington Post, we're active on social media, and you know, we feel like 10 years after we opened our doors, it's really time to sort of take this issue up a notch.
Are you the only farm animal sanctuary in the country that you know of that has the cooking program and the camp?
Yes.
What made you decide to, I mean, it makes sense, but what made you decide to tackle that?
Well, you know, people, we're asking people to change their diets. That's not an easy thing for people to do. Food is a comfort. Food has, a historical root. We have our customs and traditions around food. We all like the convenience of fast food. So if we're actually saying to good people, if you are a kind person, and if you care about animals and this planet that so desperately needs every single one of us to adopt a plant-based diet, then let us help you. If we have that expectation, we'd better make it easy for people because it's a lot to ask. It's a lot to ask, and we recognize that, and we see the terror in people's eyes like, oh my God, what do I put on my plate? So the camp and the cooking are designed to say to people, okay, you have the desire. We'll show you how. We'll show you that it can be healthy. We'll show you that it can be simple. We'll show you that it can be delicious.
And you're saying there's been a change in attitude toward that message.
Tremendous.
In 10 years.
Tremendous.
How
we're
so?
At a very different place. I think the instability in the climate, particularly in the last couple years with these back-to-back hurricanes, boom, 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 and the fact that one of them hit New York, major metropolitan area, gave us pause. I think as a country, we're looking far more seriously at the issue of global warming, and we're recognizing slowly that the problem is that we're eating animals. If you take away animals and animal production and transportation of animals to slaughterhouses, most of it really is a lot of it is about the cows and the methane that comes from the cows, then most of our problems would go away. There are a lot of climatologists who believe that if we as a country became vegan, climate change would reverse itself. So it feels like an ethical imperative. And so we need to help. I think people are slowly coming around. We don't ever get the dumb jokes anymore that we used to get on every tour. That's a nice slab of bacon. What we get is people pretty routinely asking how they would start on that journey. There are vegan restaurants popping up every day. There's now a vegan fast food chain with 200 locations around the world called Loving Hut that looks good. And it doesn't look like a place that anybody, not even a Big Mac fan, would feel like they were sacrificing if they went to. Veganism is in the news. Factory farming is in the news. There have been so many documentaries, very powerful documentaries. Lots of doctors are talking about all the issues that have come from this diet, from obesity to heart disease to high blood pressure to many, many forms of cancer. So there's a much increased level of awareness, mm-hmm. night and day from 10 years ago.
So you were talking too about the importance of getting environmentalists interested and on board.
You can call yourself an environmentalist, but you cannot be an environmentalist unless you have adopted a plant-based diet. Animal agriculture is too devastating to the planet. Methane is more toxic than carbon dioxide in terms of causing global warming. I think it's 23 times more powerful an impact. Locavorism is about the transportation issue, the belief that if you're saving the transportation, you're helping. Well, you are helping, but not a fraction like you'd help if you stopped eating animals in the first place. So I think we've got to... I know food is important. I love to eat. But we've got to get a little less selfish about this if the planet is going to be here for our grandkids.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things you've always done well is get this issue across by talking about individual animals, which leads us to your book, Animal Camp, which you've reissued and updated. What's it like to have to tell those stories? That has got to be a fun project when you just go, let me think about the animals I know here.
When you're talking about animal rescue or on the micro level, or you're talking about changing hearts and minds by helping animals because you're helping people decide not to eat them. When you look at that, all of that's being done surrounding those issues, nobody talks about the animals. We talk about the environment, we talk about human health, and we talk about the suffering of 8 billion chickens or millions of pigs or millions of cows or turkeys. What it always leaves out is who these animals are who aren't slaughtered. I want people to know and understand pigs and chickens the way we understand and revere our dogs and cats, because we know them as individuals. I've said in an interview with you before, 10 pigs are as individual as 10 people. And if I can, through Animal Camp and Blind Horse Sings or blogging on Huffington Post, through my writing, help people see them, then we fill that void, and I think it's an important piece in helping people begin the journey. You got it. People have to know and love chickens and pigs, or at least think they're kind of interesting, or at least worthy of some consideration. So I talk about Paulie the chicken who slept in my bed one night because he demanded to, and I talk about a sheep who really was a teacher and a hero. And I talk about the time a pig was so, her feelings were so hurt that she was sort of hiding in the stall, kind of crying. And so, yeah, the book is a mix of essays about the animals, very joyful, very sad when we have to say goodbye to beloved animals and the lessons we learn in those moments. That's the bulk of the book, and the probably about a third of it is an entreaty to people to tap into their goodness and to begin that journey toward a plant-based diet, whether it's for the animals who are the same as we are in all the ways that matter, or themselves and their physical health, or this planet, which is begging us to go vegan.
Kathy Stevens is the founder of the Catskill Animal Sanctuary in New York and author of Animal Camp. Find out more at cas.org. Up next, an international high fashion model who's using her fame to push for diversity, fair wages, safe working conditions, and an end to the use of underage models. If you missed part of this show or want to share it with others, visit the 51% Archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1252. Our next activist is a fashion model working to change the industry from the inside. Yomi Abiola is among modeling's elite, the first African face for Maybelline Cosmetics, appearing in Harper's Bazaar, Vogue, and Elle magazines. She's also the founder of STUFF, Stand Up for Fashion, and associate to the UNESCO Chair for Human Rights. On this week's edition of Alive and Kicking, Dr. Sharon Ufberg speaks with Abiola about STUFF, and why the fashion industry can lead the way in issues like fair pay, safe workplaces, sustainability, diversity, and women's health and self-esteem.
Yomi, as a model and contributing editor to Vogue Italia, can you tell us what exactly is Stand Up for Fashion?
Stand Up for Fashion is a global platform, as you said, that promotes corporate social responsibility in the fashion industry. Mm-hmm. And how we do that is through three ways. So we empower people through education. There are lots of people that really don't know the ins and outs of the fashion industry. And so I think we thought that it was very important for us to empower them through education. Mm-hmm. Secondly, through consulting, we work with individual corporations that have already started creating a change in a social direction, and sometimes they get a little bit stuck. So we go on ground and we do investigation and find out how we can empower them again through social change. And then the last thing is events. I really thought and I realized that fashion people only seem to get together at fashion shows, but through an event, they can actually get together and speak about the business of fashion, the social movement that's occurring in fashion, because there is a social movement taking place, and how to actually further that social movement. So those are the three ways in which we work.
I've heard you speak about your future fashion vision. Can you share some of that vision with us today?
Well, our overall vision is to leverage the fashion industry as a vehicle for social change, not just an industry. It's an industry that makes fashion and beauty together $900 billion. It just impacts so many people's lives. So we just see the possibility of actually fully leveraging it as a vehicle for social change. Think about what Michelle Obama has done with the Get Up and Go campaign, even how Anna Wintour has used her position and her power in fashion to influence politics. So we know that there is that potential, and that's what our vision is.
Fashion is so powerful. How will you leverage this power, and who will your partners be in this endeavor?
Going back to the first question that you asked is, how to make that social change. If something is sexy and it's appealing, then people will want to do it. So I really feel that, as people in fashion, we have a responsibility to show people that social change is the way to go. My partners are far and wide, and they cover every single area. They're five main areas that we cover. We cover diversity and inclusion. We cover the use of underage models. We cover fair labor, true beauty, which is about airbrushing and retouching, and intellectual property. And in all those areas, we have people that are already doing work who are part of our network. And they're also, you know, working towards our vision of leveraging and pushing the fashion industry forward in a socially responsible way.
Yomi, how can people get involved?
Well, you can come to our website, which is standupforfashion.com. Also follow us on Twitter, which is StandUpFF. That's our handle. And people are more than welcome to come and be part of the conversation.
This is Dr. Sharon Ufberg with Yomi Abiola on Alive and Kicking. Come join us on the after show at Tootsuite Social Club on Tootsuite.com.
Dr. Sharon Ufberg is an integrative healthcare practitioner and health journalist in the San Francisco area. Finally, Jill Malkin is back with a woman who made recent history. She first hit the spotlight because of the man she married, but she became a global icon because of her commitment to ending poverty, AIDS, and as an outspoken advocate of the movement to ban landmines. Her name was Diana Spencer.
Princess Di, as we would come to call her, was born into the Spencer family, whose history goes well beyond that of the House of Windsor, the present-day royal family of England. She was born in July of 1961, and although her family was aristocratic, she experienced certain things that non-royal girls do, such as boarding school and the divorce of her parents when she was 8. She was less than excellent in her school studies, but she was already noted for her activities in community work. She was adept enough at the piano to give a hasty performance later on, during the course of a tour of an Australian school, of a half minute or so from Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2. Just a smidgen, but enough to show that she had a genuine appreciation for the best music, and that it had inspired a good deal of work on her part to follow it through. She was unsuccessful at finding a job. She tried being a dance instructor, a nanny, a party hostess. She failed to find her vocation, so it did come in handy to receive for her 18th birthday an apartment worth $170,000 in the posh Earl's Court in Kensington. It helped further to receive a $100,000 engagement ring in 1980 from the son of the Queen of England, Prince Charles. They were married in 1981 in a sumptuous ceremony in St. Paul's Cathedral, as 750 million people looked on from around the world. They became cultural ambassadors, traveling to many countries for occasions of state, representing the Crown of England, making new friends and allies everywhere they went, charming everyone they met. But Prince Charles and Diana were divorced in 1996. Princess Diana found meaning for her life through the power that came with her titles. Through her travels, she became aware of the vast misery in the less affluent countries she visited, and she made it a point to visit clinics, and in particular, orphanages and children's hospitals. Her gift was the size of her heart in helping the poorest and sickest, well beyond the limits of her subjects, with a firm determination not just to make a difference, but to make palpable progress in the fight against poverty and disease. She established new organizations to fight the ravages of AIDS and leprosy among the most helpless human beings in the most impoverished countries, and more to address the issues of the elderly, the drug addicted, the youth, and the homeless. This princess, this person, was a queen of compassion. As does every walk of life, being a princess brings its own miseries. Tabloid newspapers and magazine reporters haunt the rich and powerful, failing to differentiate between those who merit their harassment and those who don't, digging up mini-scandals as well as significant ones to provide the rest of us who pay for the vicarious experience of royal sin, vice, and happenstance. Being royalty brings on the crosshairs. And although she tried to fight back, she had only limited success. The odds were just too great. The resulting pressure was not anything she'd been conditioned to deal with, and, according to her, it resulted in bulimia and depression. Princess Diana was very beautiful and elegant, and was attracted to certain desirable men of her day and had her share of friendships with them. She'd been seeing Dodi Fayed, son of the Egyptian billionaire owner of the Ritz Hotel in Paris, and it was during the course of a drive through that city one evening in 1997 that they died together in a car crash. Such was the appeal of this royal personage who exuded kindness and charity wherever she went, that at her death the world had never seen such a universal outpouring of sadness and mourning. Her image of benefactress for the downtrodden has served to double the extraordinary glow that illuminates her memory after her passing. Flowers, candles, and photos by the thousands continued to appear in Princess Diana's memory at the gates of Kensington Palace and at many other designated places around the world for many months after her funeral. And every year, on August 31st, new photos, letters, candles, wreaths, and roses appear. Her people have not forgotten her, neither should the world. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer, actor, and musician. He lives in New York's Catskill Mountains. The work to remove those hidden and deadly landmines continues to be an issue in nearly 60 countries, as we hear in this report from UN Radio.
The clearing of landmines and other explosive devices in areas affected by conflict is a crucial precursor to the deployment of international peacekeepers and humanitarian workers, according to the United Nations Mine Action Service. The organization says in regions where active conflict is in progress, such as Afghanistan, volunteers, including women, were risking their lives to clear and educate the public on the dangers of landmines. In 2012, at least 4,300 people were victims of landmines and other explosive remnants of war, according to estimates by the International Campaign to Ban Landmines. UNMAS Director Agnes Makayu says more international effort is needed to help clear landmines to enable people in conflict zones live and work without fear.
The peacekeeping operations, the special political missions, the humanitarian assistance cannot be deployed if the land is contaminated, if we do not know the scope and the nature of the contamination. The communities affected in Mali, every time you have a shelling, you have unexploded bombs, mortar shells, ordnance on the ground, and this is contamination. Usually these areas are populated. Or if they are not, they will be, because refugees and displaced people are walking the roads. And if this is not addressed, there is no stabilization, there is no security, there is no human rights, there is no humanitarian assistance. Therefore, down the line, you will not have any development.
Although the number of landmines still buried in the ground remains unknown, the United Nations estimates that 59 countries are affected to some extent by landmines and explosive remnants of war. Patrick Maigua, United Nations Radio, Geneva.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. If you'd like to connect with us on Facebook, you can find 51% there. And you can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.